I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns. Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine. This is where we reveal the embedded codes and challenge the operating systems driving our society. A celebration of the weird, quirky, and liminal space between you, me, us, and them. We're not the only species here, but we're worth keeping around too. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you're on Team Human. Playing for Team Human today, scientist, environmentalist, and futurist James Lovelock.
I think that we are a godsend to the planet, because without us, I don't think there's any chance, because there's nothing else alive on the Earth that would offset the warming up of the sun.
The 100-year-old proposer of the Gaia hypothesis will share what happens when humanity moves from the Anthropocene era into what he calls the Novocene. It's time to intervene on behalf of people. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and we're all on Team Human. I found out the other day that one of the NPR stations was looking for a new kind of radical, political, cultural, social podcast to feature on their air. And a friend of mine who runs a large nonprofit organization, he was asked, what's out there? And he suggested Team Human. And they said, yeah, we were thinking about that, but that show, and he's just kind of too dangerous. It really got me thinking. On the one hand, I mean, it's cool, but am I? Are we? Are we too dangerous? Have we gotten too off the rails, just too bizarre? I mean, it's easy to blame NPR. You know, we could say that they've changed. They've become more conservative and they're all neoliberal. But what if it's we who have changed? You know, what if we are really the radicals? And I don't just mean that in the good way. I mean, like, the bad way. Are we the weird kind of beret-wearing radicals doing some form of over-educated performance art here? You know, radicals, when you think back historically, radicals are almost always wrong, right? They're the weird students in cafes, and it's nice and all, but it's not the real world. What if they're right? What if what we're talking about here is really just too out there for the kinds of organizations that we once respected? What does that mean? I mean, who moved? Did they move? Did we move? Did we all move? They agree with us to a point, but there's this place where they think we just go off the rails, that we're too Bernie or too AOC or not Clinton enough and Biden enough. Is it that we're too willing to consider the emotional logic fueling Trumpism, or to deconstruct and criticize the way, say, the current philanthropy system supports capitalism? Or are they right? And maybe they think about us the same way we might think about, say, some of the dark web guys that have themselves gone off the rails, right? They're smart, they're educated, they mean well, but they're really just working out some childhood issues, right? Although the childhood issues may themselves have some validity. I mean, we think, oh, it's a little too weird. They're kind of, well, interesting, but not for us. Would I have taken an offer to do this show through an NPR station? I think I would have, but I'm really fine and happy doing it for you, as well as the stations that don't think we're too dangerous, like X-Ray in Portland, Oregon, KXRC in Durango, Colorado, KSPC in Claremont, California. And if you want us on your station and you have any influence on their programming decisions or the email of their program director, please let us know at team@teamhuman.fm, and we will see if we are not yet too dangerous for them. And as always, you can support this show by going to teamhuman.fm and clicking on support. We're adding new premiums, from a digital copy of my first book, Siberia, to the brand new Team Human jerseys. And if you get a Team Human membership card and free access to Team Human live events and all that kind of stuff, it really does help you feel and be a part of this team. And speaking of which, we are doing a Team Human Live in New York City at WNYC's Green Space with Reverend Billy and the Church of Stop Shopping on Thursday, March 5th. You can get info at teamhuman.fm. You can join contributors like Jason Hill, Boris Grincott, Kerry Smith, Steve Kale, Soren Lindgren, who make this commercial free and an unencumbered place, and who all get to come to Team Human Live events for free. I'm honored today to bring you a conversation with the great James Lovelock, whose Gaia hypothesis back in 1972 proposed that the Earth is a single organism, a living biosphere that regulates the Earth's atmosphere to sustain life. Well, as we all know, Gaia may be in some trouble, not just humans, but the whole thing. Only, I guess, surprisingly to me anyway, Lovelock thinks that thinking machines may provide Gaia a way through. Here's one of the most profound experiences I've had since starting the Team Human show, my conversation with James Lovelock. Well, hi, James Lovelock. It's an honor to meet you. I've read, as many of my generation did, I kept a copy of Gaia Hypothesis in my pocket the way other people kept Hermann Hesse or, On the Road or other handbooks.
Thank you. That's most encouraging to me. I thought it was pretty unpopular in America.
It was, well, with the mainstream or even with the scientific community, it was unpopular.
But that's why.
The Gaia Hypothesis spread through the New Age, the psychedelic, the environmental movements first, and then eventually it came through the early, somewhat spiritual internet crowd that I was a part of, because we saw the internet as the neural fiber of Gaia, that we were going to connect the brain cells of Gaia together with digital technology. And it came through to us at the same time as fractal mathematics, morphogenesis, David Bohm's implicate-explicate order.
Right. Yes.
I'm wondering, for you, was the initial inspiration scientific? I mean, what was the moment that the picture came together for you?
Oh, strangely, I was one of the first people in this country, Britain, to be asked by NASA to help them with looking for life on Mars and the Moon or anywhere else out there. And being a scientist, I had to kind of think, not so much a scientist, more an engineer. And I think what they really wanted of me was not more theoretical stuff. What they wanted was hardware that they could send to Mars. Now, you can't send a laboratory on an early rocket like Pioneer. It's too big, too heavy, and uses too much fuel. So I had some tiny little gadgets which you could hold in your hand that were exceedingly sensitive and could measure very small quantities of all sorts of things. And it was the ease that really got them excited, because they could easily mount those on a thing like Pioneer or something. And I also had a way of transferring a sample from the Martian surface to these gadgets that was highly effective and also lightweight. So, but it was mainly as an engineer that I think I got interested in how does the planet work, how does the Earth work, and so on.
And then was there a moment that you said to yourself, it's alive?
No, it's a very slow process. The Earth is a pretty complicated thing. I don't think anybody understands it fully yet. Well, I'm sure they don't. And so you have to wait quite a while as you build up evidence about the transfer of things. How is oxygen kept in the air? How what happens to the CO2 and so on? In fact, they're still doing it.
So do you see Gaia as the initiator or as the emergent phenomenon? In other words, what's the formal cause, as Aristotle might put it, of Gaia? Or is Gaia herself the formal cause of nature?
I don't know. I can only say that because I really don't. One can make
one well, can if make... you don't know, we're in trouble. Civilization might end without us knowing.
I don't think so. No, because it must have started long ago when there was no life form, but the precursors of bacteria and unicellular things. That's how life started. And its main objective was to maintain the environment of the planet comfortable for itself. It was selfish.
Right, but life started in one little place. I mean, it was a small thing. There was the first cell or the first bacterium, and it wasn't thinking, I'm going to maintain thermal homeostasis on the planet. It was just trying to swim around or do what it did.
Exactly.
Was there at some point that life was complex and interactive enough that it took on this function of maintaining the right temperature?
We can only make guesses about this sort of thing. I've made models of how the thing could work, and they're fairly complex. It's full of differential equations and that sort of thing. And they work fine. And I think you've got to go back further than the Earth itself and things on it, because out there in the gas clouds in the cosmos, there are all sorts of the precursors of life, chemical substances that are already formed up as spare parts of living things. This is particularly true of the big gas clouds.
Right, so they're functioning not like life, but they're self-organized on some level.
Yeah, a little bit of it, yes. And so it really, the Earth inherited at its birth a whole pile of bits and pieces of ideas on how to build chemicals, how to join them to produce effects and whatnot. And somehow by accident from that formed the system that I call Gaia.
Right. And when you say Gaia, I mean, to us, it conjures a conscious being, you know, an earth mother, godlike soul to nature. I mean, for you, is it just a name or does it have some sort of awareness?
I don't really know. As I said, I'm an engineer, not a scientist, primarily. And engineers don't bother too much about, if they build a car, they think it's a bit weird and queer to give it a life form, say, this is my so-and-so. Like, we tended to call the car we had Sleepy, and those for other reasons.
Well, you may be an engineer, but you're a humble engineer. In other words, the engineers that I run into now in Silicon Valley think that they should re-engineer reality itself. You know, they almost consider human beings are a problem that engineering can solve for, which is a tricky assumption to have made.
Well, I don't blame them. It sort of encourages them, makes them feel secure. I don't think like that. When I say I'm not a scientist, I was sort of brought up in science, and things like, I think the essence of Gaia is the equation that that famous physicist Schrödinger produced, dealing with entropy. Now, engineers are quite happy with entropy. I mean, you go right back to that Frenchman, Carnot, who showed how steam engines work, and they've clung to that sort of way of looking at things. They don't worry too much about divine forces moving it or anything like that.
In the Novocene, as compared with the Gaia hypothesis, it takes us down a potentially, well, depending on your perspective, a potentially darker road, where you begin in some ways by explaining that we're very likely alone in the universe.
Yep.
You know, and that you say that had the evolution of the solar system taken a billion years longer, there'd be no one alive to talk about it. And that's interesting. So how did you come to the conclusion that we are probably it, that this only happened once?
It wasn't mine. I got it from reading a book by a famous astronomer, Martin Rees, called Our Final Century. And that was what he suggested. And it moved me considerably, because I thought, yes, we haven't really had long enough in our cosmos for life to develop. And it's amazingly lucky that we've got it on our planet just in time.
Right, because the sun is increasing its heat.
That's right.
So that the conditions, the temperature range required for life to begin before it had the ability to maintain temperature on the planet,
exactly,
was very short. That even now it's too hot for life to start again.
Oh yes, I mean if we really make a mess of it, and global warming takes over, it'll never start again. It'll just, the Earth will be like Venus, hot and lifeless.
So in some ways, the miracle, the more amazing thing is not that human beings are capable of increasing the climate on the planet 1 or 2 degrees centigrade. It's that life was able to keep it down where it is for all this time.
Exactly. Well, in the early days, keep it warm enough too. Don't forget, if you go back a couple of billion years or so, the sun was a good bit less hot than it is now. And the problem was much more a snowball Earth that they've talked about.
Right. Life that it got too cold, things would just freeze.
Right. Yes. So it was warm enough for life in those times, and it's cool enough for life now, but it's having a struggle keeping it there.
Right. And for people who haven't looked at it, I mean, Gaia Hypothesis, the book, goes into hypothesizing about many of the different ways that the planet can sweat and respirate and use levels of saline and evaporation and volcanic ash and whatever to keep things within the range. It's a cooling and heating system for the whole planet.
Yeah. Well, if it weren't for life, the place would be full of carbon dioxide. It does a marvelous job of keeping the amount of carbon dioxide in the air down to almost a trace level. You see, you express it in parts per million. I mean, it really is, it's what, about 400 now parts per million. That's a very little. You would think it pretty rotten if your beer was only 400 parts per million of alcohol.
But then it really raises the stakes for us and what we do now as environmentalists. You know, it's not just the human species that's depending on Greta Thunberg and her friends to avert climate change. It could be life itself in the universe is at stake.
Exactly. Yeah, we are the sole representative, perhaps. And it's most important to us to keep the Earth going as a living system. So, yes. And it's not very difficult. All you have to do is to stop burning carbon.
And I mean, a lot of my friends say, well, the Earth will be fine. It's just the humans that'll get wiped out. But that's...
You would
take a more severe view.
Oh, yes. No, because it won't only be us. It'll be everything else alive. Because we're all very similar. Our temperature requirements are the ones that have made Gaia. And... keep it that way.
When I make that argument, people will tell me, oh, but there's some super strong bacteria that could live in a super hot world or that could weigh down at the bottom of the sea that would survive whatever we do.
No, it might for a little while, but it couldn't keep the whole planet suitable for it and its friends.
Right, that you need all those planktons and green things and... Mm-hmm.
You need the lot, and they've evolved. they've evolved. Gaia is right. An evolutionary system. It didn't happen by accident.
And at the same time, I mean, and you relate to it well as someone who's lived a whole century now, you say that Earth is old. Gaia is old also. And as we become, I know it at 58 now, as we age, we become more fragile.
Yeah.
And you think that the Earth herself is more fragile because of her age. She doesn't sustain the shocks as easily.
Well, something that's lived over 2 billion years is well used to the process of aging. And I wouldn't want to live 2 billion years, but it's almost ridiculous even to think of it. You can't really say Gaia's old because we don't know what the limit is.
Right. But where an asteroid strike or a nuclear accident, where Earth may have been able to shrug it off a few million years ago, you think it would be more difficult to absorb these sorts of shocks today?
Yes, an asteroid strike could kill off life on the Earth, yes, now, because we're a good bit warmer since the last one, 65 million years ago. But I don't think nuclear matters a damn. There were natural nuclear reactors in Africa about, I think I've forgotten how long ago. You can look it up in a geology book. But there were, and they ran for millions of years.
I suppose they might have also been responsible for some of the rapid periods of mutation.
Yeah. Well, I think the fear of nuclear has been badly overdone. And I strongly suspect that it's maintained by propaganda from the coal and oil industries because their business depends on making nuclear unpopular.
Right, because nuclear, especially new nuclear, it's not renewable, but it's certainly a lot closer to renewable than finding dead dinosaurs.
That's right, and it would keep us going for quite a long time, a time to discover what we really should be doing. But not only nuclear, but some forms of renewable energy may also be usable and do the job. But that's really only us behaving like Gaian things.
Right. When we do, I think we're happier and stand a better chance. I mean, an almost non-Gaian, well, they would look at it as Gaian. Folks like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk think that the priority is to get us off the planet.
You know, that's utterly crazy. Utterly crazy.
why is it crazy, especially compared to, you know, space research compared to Earth research?
Oh, no, I'm all in favor of space research, sending small automated vehicles to other planets if we that's as far as we can get, and finding out about them. I'm all for that, as long as you don't let it take over everything you're doing and take over all of the funds available for scientific investigation. No, I think I'm in favor of it. But Jeff Bezos' idea of carting us as people out there to Mars is just crazy.
Well, they try to, they use the Earth example of bees send out scouts to find places for other hives. And if humans don't learn to do the same thing, some sort of space migration, then we'll never get our second hive.
The bees fly through the air that Gaia has put there for them, and it suits them. Space is just something. We don't know who made space, but it certainly wasn't in our favor. You try breathing it.
Right, so you think that space might be somehow sterilizing? It's outside the living part of the universe.
Yes, and that's pretty small.
So you think the way, the real key to human sustainability, other than just stopping carbon, would be really learning about heat? Because we could become conscious enactors of Gaia rather than just unconsciously depending on her to maintain a proper degree range.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, I think you're right.
Beyond your work and a few others, we haven't done that much work into looking at how does the Earth maintain this system, this temperature range.
I mean, I'm only 100 now. Nobody's been doing it for long. I think this is it. Science and knowledge about the Earth moves fairly slowly in human terms. And I can foresee in the next 20 or 30 years, as climate science becomes more and more important and occupies our attention more, we'll probably solve many of those problems of how it works.
Well, a lot of that, I mean, and you talk about it in the Nova Scene, is people have to learn to think like Gaia, that
yep.
that we have to sort of move beyond. I mean, and we should have since Norbert Wiener and Gregory Bateson, we've understood systems theory, but
yes.
that we don't seem to respect Gaia as a dynamic system. We're still using cause and effect knowledge to understand her workings.
Yes, well, I don't know why they don't. I think the problem is a lot of typical human prejudice. If it wasn't our idea or our nation's idea, it can't be any good. It's that sort of thing. We're humans with a lot of fallibility to us, and I don't know if I'm right. I hope I am, but. It is just, as I say, an engineer's way of looking at the planet.
Well, it's not just an engineer's way, though. It feels like to get a sort of a Gaia consciousness, you need to employ, although maybe engineers would say they do, but you need to employ a much more archetypally female, intuitive, unconscious, soft focus, holistic perspective, a way of seeing, don't you?
Well, engineers are intuitive. I mean, most of the things they invent and discover, they discover because somebody in the room or just outside said, I wish somebody would invent a thing that would do this or that. And then the idea floods into their mind. They don't get it as a dream, sleeping, or just an inspiration. It's usually an answer to a question.
I mean, it feels like this sort of science, if I could be so bold as to call it a type of science. But the character of the science is not like Francis Bacon taking nature by the forelock and subduing her to our will. You know, the father of empirical thought, the way he described science was to be able to dominate nature. That these sorts of insights don't come from that. It comes from a different place.
Well, I think a better sort of character than Bacon was Faraday. Remember, he had almost no schooling. He was almost illiterate when he started and certainly couldn't do mathematics. But almost everything electrical that we use, you can trace back to Faraday. It was inspiration, that sort of thing, that led him on.
It's interesting. The part of this book that then disturbed me was when you pivoted from what life can do and what humans have done and how humans have been the only thinking conscious beings around, to the idea that we're about to be joined by cyborgs and move into the Nova scene. And yeah. Human beings, I'm certainly not used to other things being able to think the way we do. But you believe that is going to come.
Well, I like to think of the Earth as the famous biologist, Lynn Margulis, with whom I used to work. She had I don't know that it was hers, but she certainly was much moved by an image of life on Earth as made up of five kingdoms, the animals, the plants, the bacteria and the fungi, and one other, the proctocysts. And the cyborgs really, to me, represent another kingdom, which has evolved from us. And I don't know what its form was. I mean, we know damn all about it. What started me with the Nova scene was I got more and more fed up with the failure to really move ahead from Carol Čepek's book, Rossum's Universal Robots, which was written in 1920s. And we still talk about robots. We seem to think of a highly intelligent automated vacuum cleaner as running the planet. Well, I mean, it's just not on. I wanted something a bit more mysterious than that. And hence the cyborgs and the scene.
Right, it wouldn't be a Roomba or whatever they're called running the world. And when you talk about the cyborgs digital life, you describe it as now that solar energy can be transformed directly into information in ways that it really couldn't before.
Well, that's our job, and we're doing it. And there's lots of side aspects to that. I mean, one way, most people wouldn't think feasible, but it would be, in a minor way, to cool the planet, to offset global warming, by broadcasting from enormous radio transmitters all the junk television there is. You know, the programs that are just not worth a damn, because that would be throwing entropy out into space, getting rid of it. That's what Venus does. Most people don't know that the Earth, if you look at it from far out in space, a long way away from the sun, it looks warmer than Venus does. It's radiating more heat. And the reason for that is, of course, Gaia at work, throwing the heat out into space to keep us cool. And Venus can't do that.
And if we were throwing out old episodes of I Love Lucy into space,
well,
you've
got your
planet.
Favorite hate program, yes, so have I.
But I mean, good television would do it as easily as bad in terms of the energy.
In terms of entropy loss, yes, it would. But why waste good television doing that? Oh dear.
Oh my gosh. So you say in the book that, you know, 47 degrees Celsius, that it sets the limit for any kind of life,
yes,
on an ocean planet, even for silicon-based intelligence, that it wouldn't be able to tolerate
anything
it anymore.
Would be knocked off, because we would rapidly, as a planet, change to a state like Venus. The temperature would be about 250 Celsius. That's the kind of temperature it would go up to. Well, you can't live at that. I mean, that's a hot oven.
So you think then that even if the singularity came, and computers or cyborgs were, you know, smarter and better equipped than us, that they're still going to want us around because we'll be able to help them keep the planet cool?
I think so. But I don't know how, of course. And that's for the next book, if I survive that long.
I mean, a lot of the things that we humans try to do to fix the problem aren't actually, if we looked at them systemically, they're not so great. Like plastic recycling. You know, we all in America, I'm sure they do there. We stick our plastic in these bins and they take them off and then they melt them down into new plastic. You think, if you look at all of the inputs and outputs, you think that that's a fool's errand, right?
I think so. Well, yes, I would agree up to a point. Although we don't have much alternative. You can't let them pile up into the environment as a great big mess. You've got to collect them and dispose of them in the best way you can think of.
But do you think it uses more heat to melt them down into something else and reprocess them than it would just to bury them somewhere?
If you really think you want to do something about global warming, the thing is you just stop digging for coal and pumping up oil. Just stop it altogether. It's a bad thing to do, and it'll kill us all if we can't go on doing it.
And it's a bad thing. It's not technologically required, even at this stage of our engineering capability. It's not technologically required. It's just economically required because we have a growth-based, corporate-driven economic operating system.
And not only that, but people are selfish naturally, and they think in terms of their own pensions and funds and stuff that's coming from the investments in coal and oil and so on, and that they can't bear the thought of not having it.
Right. And that's an argument that's been made against me. I mean, when I've gone to conferences and talked about, you know, transitioning away from coal and the growth-based economy, and they'll say, well, yes, but if you replace Exxon and Sunoco with a nuclear power plant, what happens to the old lady who's depending on her dividends from Exxon stock?
Exactly. Exactly. You know, you're so right. To say nothing of the various guys that have put their money in it.
Right. Well, they only want to talk because you want to think about the poor old lady in her apartment who can't feed her cat if she doesn't have her coupons clipping. And as if there's no other way to get her the money she needs once we're using more renewable energy, as if the money just goes away.
It doesn't. It finds its... I don't know right. how... I'm not an economist. I don't know how it works. It's all mystery to me. But it always seems to work. We've been through some pretty rough periods on these islands during World War II, for example, during the Suez Crisis. And it's amazing how quickly you get by when there's a shortage of something. In fact, people were healthier during World War II than they were in peacetime.
And they were moving their bodies a bunch. I mean, everyone was healthier except the people on the you know, yes. on the battlefield and in the concentration camps. You know, other people.
Well, that was, the people no, not on the... I'm sorry, I was being selfish. I was thinking of us here rather than...
right. It's true. The people at home were doing better. Yeah. So you talk about, as we shift from the Anthropocene or whatever we're in to the Novocene, that natural selection that's driven evolution up till now, it's going to actually move into something more like a purposeful selection.
Well, evolution is absolutely solid. There are those that don't believe in it, but I don't think their case is very strong. It happens. So why not have it happen to us? There'll be from us will evolve cyborgs or whatever, just in the same way as from fusion of individual small cells in the oceans long ago, there came plants and animals.
But it's a bigger transition, though, because it's not just, you know, water to land or to air, but from genes to code. You know, we're talking going from DNA to COBOL or...
No, we're not. The only problem with DNA and those things is they're too damn slow. If you send a signal along a nerve, it travels at a million times slower than sending a signal along a copper wire. It's almost exactly a million. And if we're going to have cyborgs evolve from us, we have to have a different nervous conduction system. I don't know how. Don't ask me. It's not my job. but we have to.
You suggest, or you state directly, you say, you know, the bit is the fundamental particle from which the universe is formed.
Oh, that's just... Sorry, that I have said that, but it's a speculation. I've no proof of it.
On the one hand, it's inspiring. On the other hand, that's a scary thought. It kind of goes against what feels like a more spiritual sensibility about the world. It moves into that sort of Ray Kurzweil area that evolution is the process of information looking for more and more complex hosts. And as computers can handle complexity better than humans, that information will move from us to them, and we should pass the torch and gracefully accept our own obsolescence. And that was part of what led me to want to do Team Human. I don't like the idea of being obsolete. I feel like human beings can do things that computers can't. We can embrace paradox. We can experience awe. We don't have to resolve things to ones and zeros. We can stay in that liminal space between things. And I'm concerned if we just decide, well, computers are our successors and we'll pass the torch and fade into the background, that Gaia dies, that it, computers cannot shepherd this thing.
Well, I think you're pushing it, the notion of the ability of computers, far too far. When we appeared on the planet, animals appeared on the planet, the plants didn't die off. They formed a relationship with the animals. The animals, like us, actually plant the plants and use them for, cycle them for food. And we supply the carbon dioxide back so that they can grow in the sunlight. It's a mutual process, and evolution always considers that. The appearance of humans on the planet does not necessarily mean the loss of plants.
Right, it may, but it doesn't have to.
If we're idiots, we need all five kingdoms to keep things going. I mean, the fungi are needed to transfer the rare elements from the rocks to the plants, and then from the plants to us. You wouldn't have cobalt and iodine if it weren't for the plants.
Right. And likely, if a new form of life emerges, if we want to call it a digital life or a Novocene native life form, that we would be mutually interdependent.
Yeah, indeed we would. Although just how is very hard. I mean, I don't think anybody has a guess.
Right, because I always look at examples like cancer, and you know, environmentalists will tell me, "Oh, well, human beings, we are the cancer destroying the planet. You know, we're killing our host." And folks maybe more like me would say, "Oh, but you know, maybe digital life is the cancer that's going to grow exponentially when nothing in nature can really grow exponentially other than markets, which destroy humans." I just find that many of the enthusiasts for digital life are kind of libertarians who see in digital the ability to do the exponential growth that real society has been unable to provide the markets.
You shouldn't be too hard on cancer. Look at it as a form of waste disposal for animals and plants. What use would it be for me to live twice as long as I've lived? I mean, I'd be really worn out. I don't have anything like the strength or intelligence I had maybe 20 or 30 years ago. And if I go on another 30 years, I'll be just a doddering old idiot.
Well, on a personal level, though, do you think that if you were to die, which you probably think is going to happen at some point, but I'm going to still make it an if, because we don't know for sure. Have you contemplated what happens then? Do you think it just stops, or do you think some form of energy awareness moves on after that?
Oh, no, there's a lot of bacteria and other things will be eating up the debris that I leave behind.
And that's about it. So you think when the brain shuts down, you're not going to go to some dreamy space with other people who've passed?
Well, I may be wrong, but I just don't see it. And I'm not unhappy as a result.
Well, I don't worry. I'm not so unhappy about me dying as an individual, but I do get concerned then if the planet dies, if Gaia dies.
Oh, that would be
where
terrible.
Does it go?
That would be absolutely disastrous. But think back to, I forgot who it was. Maybe it was Isaac Asimov. Who was it suggested the whole damn show is just one big game and it would just be a case of whoever's playing Gaia loses? And they wrap up the bits and pieces and start all over again. We don't know.
Right, which wouldn't be so terrible.
No.
A lot of my peers think that we're living in a simulation now, that this isn't even
real. There you go. I mean, we just don't know.
Yeah, I decided that even if it is, they've done such a good job. I'm going to accept it as if it were real.
Well, Gaia's done a good job. I mean, 2 billion years, it's pretty good going.
Yeah, no, she's done well. She's done a good job. And even if she does, you know, conk out now, she sure gave it a good fighting try. My gosh.
Absolutely. Yes, that's it.
But you also suggest, though, that it's possible that once we're deep into the Novocene, that machines could potentially build a complex, sustainable planet. That maybe even from carbon atoms somehow. If this planet were not going to work anymore, they could go somewhere else, or they would go somewhere cooler, so maybe out to Uranus or Neptune or somewhere where, you know, they could build new robot machines.
No, I don't think any of the other chunks of rock circling the sun are any use whatever as homes for life, apart from the Earth. And the Earth is suitable because Gaia has kept it that way. It happened to pass through a phase 2 billion or more years ago when life formed and started going. And it had the option then, are you going to keep it like this? And the answer was, yes, you have to. And it has.
I mean, I think a lot about, can Gaia become completely inorganic? It would take, I mean, a long time, obviously. Computers will need us and life to maintain homeostasis. But if they developed machines, solar-powered, who knows what, to do similar things to atoms and molecules, to maintain somehow a good temperature, and they let life, you know, they let life go, do you think that Gaia can stay alive in digital form, in, you know what I mean, in some sort of more pure informational form?
I don't think so, for several reasons. One is there isn't time to do the... You see, it's taken 2 billion years for organic life to develop to our sort of levels, at least 2 billion years. We've got almost no time at all left with the sun warming up. I mean, I think Martin Rees's book, Our Final Century, I mean, puts the timescale more in place than we realize.
Some people have interpreted the new book as if you're on board with, Kurzweil and the transhumanists, and that, you know, well, computers are coming and digital tech, and we should just upload our consciousness and leave carbon-based life forms behind. You're not saying that at all. You're talking about more of a symbiosis of sorts with this new kingdom of life that we'll create.
Well, they're putting in my mouth all sorts of things I haven't said, I think, in saying that. I just don't know. All I do know is that evolution happens. It's a constant almost of the present system. And I think Darwin was right. It's just going on. And but what form it'll take? I mean, it's a bit like asking a crocodile, do you suppose that you'll be talking on television in so many years to come? He wouldn't know. We didn't evolve from crocodiles. We evolved from something else. But evolution just goes on. Things keep changing to suit the changing needs.
Right. But do you feel that evolution has intention? In other words, is it you sort of random mutation, or is life groping towards something?
A lot of it can be explained by random. You can make models, mathematical models of systems, and they seem to work all right. But I don't know if that is really simulates what is happening.
I remember back, it must have been back in the 50s or 60s, Gregory Bateson gave this famous speech. It was about conscious purpose versus nature. And it was this sort of milestone in what I think was an effort to paint humanity as somehow unnatural and hostile to the rest of creation. You know, and it led in a good way, it led to the environmental movement and the Earth Day. But I wonder if this is if it's being expressed today in this notion of the Anthropocene, in which humanity has irrevocably altered the natural world at some geological level negatively, and thus humans need to be on one level or other. Humans need to be eliminated.
I think I'm wholly against that idea. Absolutely against it. I think that we are a godsend to the planet, because without us, I don't think there's any chance, because there's nothing else alive on the Earth that would offset the warming up of the sun. The sun warms up inevitably, and eventually, and not so long in the future, it'll reach a state of heat output where no life can survive on the Earth. And the only thing that can offset that time limit is us, or what, our descendants. And but we won't stop it altogether.
But do you think the Earth needed to evolve conscious, self-conscious beings like us in order to be able to now engineer solutions willfully and consciously that sort of random bacteria couldn't figure out on their own?
Exactly.
So we're a good thing.
Oh, of course we're a good thing. I never had a chance to talk to you about it otherwise.
So you're on team human then.
Oh dear.
Oh, I feel a lot better now.
This is a fun program, I can see.
Thank you. It's fun talking to you. You know, I so appreciate you taking your day and your increasingly limited time to spend with us and to share this with us. And I am looking forward to the next book that you write. Are you started on a new inquiry now? Are you looking forward to another?
Yes.
What are you working on?
Oh, yes, I'm thinking about it very much. Yes. I think the big question I've got facing me is, well, what form will this new kingdom of life take? I mean, we've got, as I said, we've got animals, plants, fungi and so on. Well, what's the next, the Novocenus, what form are they going to take? What will they be? I dislike the early idea that they're just mechanical robots, because I think this is too human, too primitive, and so on. But what is going to evolve next? And that's an intriguing question to me, and I'll make some guesses about it.
I keep thinking back to Cain and Abel, you know, and what can human beings actually create? You know, Cain gets punished mainly. They think, oh, he just sacrificed vegetables and God doesn't like plants. No, you know, in Midrash, in Torah study, it's argued that the reason God was mad at Cain was because he sacrificed something that he believed he created. Whereas Abel killed an animal that clearly God created. Cain comes in, here, I made this for you. And God's like, you didn't make that. I made that. You know, you just cut it down. You reaped it.
There's a lot of good stuff in the Bible.
Yeah, but that digital life, that as long as we think of digital life as something that we alone created, we're not really going to understand it. That once we understand that digital life is us in partnership with nature, nourishing, you know, growing something else, that's when it gets interesting to me.
And you're absolutely right. It's the right way to look at it.
Oh, well, beautiful. This is a life goal of mine since I had my first of the, I mean, they don't even make them anymore, the mass paperback edition of Gaia Hypothesis, you know, just to live in a world where I, by the time I was writing, there were no mass paperbacks anymore, but to have had your words mass produced on pulp paper, it could feel cheapening, but to me it's so replicative. It's like your words became like pollen and spread in ways that ideas don't seem to spread anymore unless they're on Twitter. I'm so grateful to have the time of your body, your whole organism, thinking with me is a pleasure and a deep, deep honor.
And thank you the same way. I really enjoyed this program. You really have done my spirit good.
Thanks for joining Team Human. Our guest today was scientist James Lovelock. You can find out more about him and his new book, The Novocene, at jameslovelock.org. You can find out more about Lovelock and all our guests at teamhuman.fm, where you can also become a subscriber and contributing supporter of this show. Team Human is a production of the Laboratory for Digital Humanism at Queen's College. Our editor is Luke Robert Mason. Our producer is Josh Chapdelin. And special thanks to Brian Appleyard, the co-writer of Novocene, who first reached out and then connected us with Lovelock himself. Without you, this would not have happened. You've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.